Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
G'day, Mark Kenny here with Democracy Sausage again for another week. I'm, of course, from the ANU's School of Politics and International Relations and the Australian Studies Institute, and I'm joined, as usual, by Dr. Maria Tafalaga, who's also from the School of Politics and International Relations here at ANU. Hi there, Maria.
Hello, Mark. How are you?
I'm going very well. In fact, I've just been watching, and we'll talk about this in a moment, I've just been watching Peter Dutton announce a reshuffle in which Karen Andrews, the former Home Affairs Minister, has stepped down from the front bench and will be leaving Parliament at the next election, presumably not by a by-election because they don't tend to go all that well at the moment. And Jacinta Namagimba-Price has been selected for the position of Indigenous Affairs spokesperson. So that's quite interesting in terms of the direct head-to-head matchup that she will now have with Linda Burney and the context of the very big issue this country is confronting this year, The Voice. And some other, you know, there's been some other changes as well. So we can talk about that in a moment, because last week on this podcast, we talked with Cos Samaras, a Labor-aligned researcher and campaign advisor, and we were really talking about changes, demographic changes in the electorate, the baby boomers and Gen Xers shuffling off, perhaps not the Gen Xers just yet, but certainly contracting as a group over time and being replaced by millennials and Gen Zs, and how that's actually affecting attitudes in the electorate and how the parties are responding to that. And of course, that all came off the back of the Aston by-election, which was a very historic result, really, because we hadn't seen a party lose a by-election to a government in over 100 years, and then suddenly it happened. So we're going to stay with that theme this week and look at the challenge for the Liberal Party from inside the Liberal Party, which is a very appropriate thing to do. And our very distinguished guest to do that with is Trent Zimmerman, former MP for North Sydney, a leading moderate, and as you'll hear, someone with a fantastic broadcast voice. Trent Zimmerman, welcome to Democracy Sausage.
Thanks for having me, Mark and Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, it's really good to talk to you. Of course, you went out of the parliament at the last election, swept away by, you know, what's been described as the kind of teal wave, you know, that election where a number of, I suppose, what you'd call urban, inner urban kind of liberal jewels were surrendered to these independent candidates. And so you have a pretty unique and I suppose, a pretty engaged perspective on what's going on in the electorate and, you know, how that's changing the prospects for the Liberal Party. We know Peter Dutton at the last, just after the last election when he took over as leader, rather curiously in my view, and I want to get your thoughts on this, sort of stated right up front, apart from not saying anything about having heard the electorate's message or anything else at, in his first press conference, he rather defiantly said that, I'm paraphrasing him here, of course, but along the lines of, you know, we're not going to be seeking to, you know, get these teal seats back. We're going to seek to build the Liberal Party's brand in the suburbs rather than the urban seats, in the sort of outer fringes and or the outer areas of the cities and regions, rather than trying to go for these inner urban seats like yours and Josh Frydenberg's and a number of others, Tim Wilson's. What's your perspective on that argument, given what happened in Aston?
Well, I don't think the maths stack up for that politically. And if you look at where we need to and can win seats, then it's winning back some of those seats that we lost to Tealey independents, but also worth noting that we lost to Labor in seats like Higgins and Boothby as well. So it's not just a Teal battle, but there has always been this narrative from some elements of the party and the media that there is this pot of political gold at the end of the rainbow in outer metropolitan areas, in my case in Sydney, in Western Sydney, which will replace those traditional Liberal seats that we have seemed to have lost, or we did lose at the last election. And I just don't think that stacks up because if you look at through any realistic lens, if you look at, for example, Western Sydney, which I know a bit better than other capital cities, there really aren't that many seats that you'd identify as realistic prospects. Yes, in landslide elections, there are Western Sydney seats that we've held before that we don't hold today, like Parramatta or MacArthur or Macquarie, or even a Greenway when it had different political boundaries. But if you look at the recent trends in those seats, it hasn't really provided any comfort to the view that they're seats that really should be on our shortlist or our key seats list, as we call it internally, for us to win. And that's why I think that any strategy that thinks that winning back seats like that, which I held, isn't central to what we need to do to return to government is one that will disappoint in the end.
Can I ask, Trent, I mean, yeah, you make a very good point. And I know that that's a line that's been sort of pushed inside the party since like the late 70s. So it's had a lot of time in the field. But I guess I want to know a bit more about the sort of resource challenge. You know, I mean, seats like yours were very important, not only for representing a certain class of people, but also, I understand, for fundraising purposes. What are the implications for ceding this ground?
Well, it's certainly true that some of these seats, which are home to some of Australia's most high net worth individuals, were a considerable source and centre of fundraising activity for the party. And the fundraising both supported local campaigns, but also was effectively redistributed to support campaigns elsewhere that weren't as fundraising rich, if I can put it that way. And the impact of what we've seen happen is both fundraising, but also just as importantly, manpower. There were days when Liberal Party branches in a seat like North Sydney, our members would be supporting the local campaign, but also dispatched to support marginal seat campaigns elsewhere in the state and the city. And when you've got the luxury of doing that, that's fine. But the current political dynamic, of course, is that you are seeing effectively us having to bunker down in those seats to protect them. We failed, obviously, at the last election. But moving forward, as we try to reclaim those seats, it means that resources that wouldn't have been spent in those seats, manpower that wasn't used in those seats, will now be dedicated to trying to rewin seats that we lost.
In your seat, what were the issues in North Sydney? I assume that a lot of these issues are quite common across a number of these electorates. But what did you see as the issues on which your party was rejected at the 2022 election?
Look, it's always hard to define because every voter has their own shopping basket of issues that they walk into a polling booth with. But there were clearly themes There was dissatisfaction with Liberal Party leadership, but there's no question about that. It was the most common refrain that I received that, as I campaigned and on polling booths. There was a fair amount of personalised anger, I think, towards Scott Morrison as Prime Minister. But that reflected not just concerns about his own personal style, it reflected a view that he wasn't representing them on some key political issues. And chief amongst those in an electorate like North Sydney was our response to climate change. Issues like how we manage integrity, and the Integrity Commission, I think, played a significant role in that respect and our failure to implement one. And there are also unique issues which are quite interesting to explore and quite difficult for the party. And chief amongst those was, I think, the deterioration of our support in the Australian Chinese community, which had traditionally in recent decades been reasonably strong for the Liberal Party. And it affected seats like mine, which includes a large part of Chatswood, which is a major centre for Chinese Australians, but other seats around the country, not just the Teal seats, if I can put it that way, but seats like Reid and Bennelong and obviously Chisholm, which were profoundly impacted, I think, by the loss of support of Chinese Australians. And that's obviously a whole different subject matter of its own, which I'm happy to explore with you.
Well, let's just stay with that for a moment, because if we think back to Bennelong when Maxine McHugh won that seat in 2007, wasn't it? She unseated John Howard at that moment when the Howard government went out of existence as well. And that was said to have been on the back of at least pretty good performance by Labor, by McHugh herself as a candidate in the Chinese community there. And you mentioned the seat of Chisholm, where there was a Chinese-Australian member of parliament. And it's interesting that it does seem that the sort of saber-rattling or tough talk, or however you want to describe it, that was going on under the Morrison government really played poorly with the Chinese community. But it suggests that community is quite kind of volatile, quite fungible, in the sense that you can speak to it if you get your messaging right.
Look, I think that's right. And it's a part of the Australian society which is probably more squarely focused on economic aspiration and opportunity. And traditionally, the Liberal Party's message in that regard has attracted support from the Chinese Australian community. But it's actually, I think, a little bit of a dilemma for not just us, but frankly, even the current government, as we see tensions rise in the Pacific. And it's quite an interesting phenomenon, because the Chinese Australian community largely came here for better economic opportunities, obviously better lifestyle and the freedoms that Australia affords its citizens. But by the same token, Chinese Australians are very proud of their heritage. They're very proud of being part of a culture which really led global civilization for so many hundreds and hundreds of years, and rightly so. The challenge, I think, politically is that sometimes when a political party or its political leadership is seen to be hostile towards the leadership of China, it translates to a perception that we're hostile towards Chinese values, Chinese heritage, and a broader picture rather than the contemporary leadership. And that, I think, therefore means that language is really important. Calling out racism is really important. Having a nuanced presentation of those arguments is vital. And it is tricky because, frankly, the stand that our government took in relation to what I perceive to be a changing Chinese approach from its leadership, I think was the right one. We have seen China change in its approach to world affairs in quite an aggressive and confrontational way. Which has only been walked back in the last 12 months, as I think that they realised that was causing problems for them economically. But I just don't think we got the language right as we presented our arguments in relation to that. And it was overlaid with a couple of incidents which actually ricocheted around the Chinese-Australian community in a way that I don't think that we probably perceived strongly enough. So, for example, something that came up time and time again with me was when former Senator Erica Betts took on two Chinese witnesses before a Senate committee hearing and really questioned their loyalty to Australia and their patriotism in quite an aggressive and unpleasant way. And that should have been called out strongly and immediately, and at the time it wasn't. So relatively small things like that create a perception of where the party itself stands. In contrast, I think Labor at the moment, even though fundamentally their approach to China on security issues, as reflected in the AUKUS decision, hasn't changed, there has been, I think, a more significant nuance in language, which means that I think that support for Labor in the Chinese-Australian community will be higher than traditionally at the moment. So we have to think about those issues.
Is that what happens toward the end of a government, that you get this kind of almost loss of perspective after you've been there for a while? There seemed to be, I was watching this in real time, as many people were, and there seemed to be almost like a rhetorical race to see who could be, you know, the toughest in their sort of China messaging, anti-China messaging. It was partly to presumably position Labor in opposition as not being as hairy-chested on these questions. And so you had people like James Patterson, who's just been promoted today to the front bench, Andrew Hastie, Dutton himself talking about, you know, drums of war. There were comments from the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, as well. There was this kind of auction, really, of tough talk. And there was pretty tough and adolescent sort of language coming from the other side of the Pacific, you know, from China as well. But I wonder if it's the kind of I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but the kind of dysfunction that creeps into governments after as they get a bit older and perhaps are starting to get a bit desperate as well.
Look, I think it's a broader problem sometimes with political discussion in Australia, and you get extreme language used on both sides. And I think it is it is increasingly failing, I think, to cut through in terms of the Australian population. It's not very sophisticated, and it has consequences. It has consequences for our support amongst a key demographic, as we saw. And the challenge is that the approach of the Morrison government and frankly Turnbull before him as well in relation to China was, I think, genuinely founded in a change of approach that we saw from the Chinese leadership, and justified. I think that we have seen a more aggressive China on the world stage. We've seen it more aggressive in relation to its activities in democracies like Australia, including amongst its diaspora. And so responding to that was a necessity. And I also think that there is an important role for government in making, in not sounding the alarm bells, but being honest with the Australian community about where some of those tensions stand. But within that, I come back to the central point that you have to prosecute those arguments in a way that is more sophisticated, that is more nuanced, that doesn't leave a section of the Australian community feeling like they themselves are under attack. And that was the missing link in all of that picture.
I mean, yeah, there's lots of things going on there. I mean, I think you're right, Trent, that it is quite complicated. If we look at the sort of demographic characteristics of Chinese migrants compared to other migrant waves that are currently underway or historically, you know, they're more highly educated. They have different kinds of aspirations. And so that's why I think the Liberal Party has been very successful in recruiting them to their vision of the good life. But, you know, You're absolutely right, Trent. When these sort of attacks, that all these rhetorical flourishes that happen, are charged with this sort of emotional dimension, it's really dangerous for political parties, because it's very likely that these voters actually never forget this. And when they're talking to their grandchildren in 50 years' time, they'll be railing about this issue, right? And I witnessed this with my own parents and in my own kind of migrant community. And I would say that Labor is, I think, a little bit more skilled at talking around questions of multiculturalism than the coalition, just in the way that the coalition is far more skilled at talking about religion and faith than Labor is. So that there's just more tools there in their ability to communicate to these sort of really emotional things that can, for certain classes of voters, just never really wash out of the system.
Look, I'm not quite sure how long-lasting they are, because I think, as Mark mentioned before, part of the reasons we lost Bennelong was because of perceptions about John Howard that dated, and this was, I suppose, quite long-lasting in John Howard's case, dating back to comments that he made, I think, when he was leader of the opposition.
Which was 88, I think, yeah, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. But we regained Bennelong pretty quickly, and we regained it, and John Alexander had very strong support from his local Chinese community and for that matter, the Korean community. But so I suppose that was an example of it enduring for a while, but it doesn't necessarily endure forever. But I think the other fact, which I think is also an overlay of this, is that I think that there was a COVID impact as well, because particularly in the early days of the pandemic, I think Chinese-Australian community was subject to some pretty awful direct but also indirect attacks because of the origins of COVID in China. And so there was a broader sense of being under assault, and that fed into the narrative as well.
Let's take a very quick break there and be back in just a moment.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage from ANU. We're talking with Trent Zimmerman, former member for North Sydney in the federal parliament, a very prominent moderate in the Liberal Party. And we're talking about really where the Liberal Party is at the moment. Fascinating kind of historical juncture, I guess, because according to some of the analyses we're seeing around, the demographics are shifting away from the Liberal Party. Trent, do you see that issue itself as a big challenge, that in fact the base of the Liberal Party is dwindling, that is the traditional base, you know, the people who've got older and tended to become more conservative and so forth, the baby boomers? Is there a structural problem now that the Liberal Party faces that it's going to really need to have to sort of find ways of engaging with newer and younger voters?
Yes, fundamentally, that's, I think, the greatest challenge the party has today. And I think that our core vote has become solidified in those over 50. But what we're seeing is increasingly different parts of society. I'd include many women in that, but particularly younger voters not joining the Liberal Party, either membership-wise or politically in terms of their voting intentions. And that is fundamentally a problem. I think once upon a time, there was a perception that people were more likely to vote for a centre-left party in their teens and 20s, but as they grew older, they would see sense and they'd move to the coalition. I just don't know that trend is still existing today. And I think that reflects basically a change in the way in which Australians are thinking. Now, does that mean that the Liberal Party is consigned to history? I don't think so, because I think that essentially that demographic, that younger demographic, can and should be very attracted to many of our economic messages, our support for aspiration, things like their natural desire to be able to afford to get into home ownership, things like our personal income tax plan, which have been criticised in some quarters. I found from my own personal experience that I was getting very positive feedback about that from constituents who were in the under 40 age groups, who wanted to say as their income grew to not be penalised to the degree that the tax system was. But where I think that we've missed them is on other issues, and I'd say climate change is an example of that. Today, the Voice is an example of that. Support for the Voice in the public polls is running at close to 70% in under 35s. Even though something that happened under our government, something like marriage equality really unified and motivated younger voters. And whilst obviously that happened with support of a Liberal Prime Minister and with Liberals like me, there was a perception that resistance to a change which was considered to be a no-brainer was coming from elements of the Liberal Party or the coalition.
And it was. I mean, you know, in a sense, the party was dragged kicking and screaming to that postal survey as it eventually emerged. And there was, you know, a fair amount of umbrage about even having that survey when it was open to the parliament to make the change. I, as you may recall, wrote at the time that, funnily enough, that probably cemented the change, gave it much stronger legitimacy that it ended up having that process, even though many people found it offensive and stressful and thought it was deeply flawed. But nonetheless, I think the fact that there was such a strong vote for it when that postal survey did occur really made it impossible for any future party of either side really to say, oh, well, you know, we don't think there's public support for this, which may not have been the case with a simple parliamentary vote, you know, with the standard three vote majority out of the House of Representatives. But, you know, just quickly on those issues you mentioned, things like women, the treatment of women and the role of women and where women are electorally now, professional women in particular, moving away from the Liberal Party, its position on climate, which has not got any better, even after losing an election where it was such a key feature. Corruption and integrity, well, I think there's been some progress on that. But there's been, you know, considerable attachment to culture war fights continuing. Yes, it's no longer on same-sex marriage, but it's moved on to a whole sort of heated argument about transgender rights and so forth. It just feels like where the Liberal Party needs stronger moderates to sort of help it make this adjustment, and they're not there.
Well, I won't disagree with that, Mark. And obviously that was one of the byproducts of the teal wave that we saw. But you know, I do think
so,
we have
so
an
was that you disagree with it or you disagree or you agree? Because as you say, a good many moderates were wiped out in the teal wave, right?
So correct.
I suppose what I'm saying is in the parliamentary party, I mean, we've seen Julian Lisa take that very principled stand. We've seen a number of moderates outside the party, including yourself, strongly in favour of the yes vote. But you know, there just isn't an engine room of any real significance inside the party anymore for making this change. And so we see the party's moved strongly to this no position. Just before we started recording this conversation, as I mentioned before, Peter Dutton's announced a reshuffle. Karen Andrews is gone from the front bench. She's decided to leave the parliament at the next election. A number of conservatives have been elevated. The leading no and national, Jacinda Namagimpa-Price, is now in that Indigenous Affairs portfolio. And I think these young voters are going to be looking at all of these things and say, well, where's the evidence that this party is even wanting to speak to us?
Well, I think the contrast is, and the demonstration of what happens when that alternative is presented, is what is happening at the state level in many states within the Liberal Party. And New South Wales, obviously, I know best, but I think it's also where there's the most dramatic indication of that. And it seems odd talking about it in these terms, having just lost the New South Wales election. But the reality is that there were a whole range of factors that went to that loss, particularly, I think, just longevity and time for a change. But what is most pronounced about that election result is the fact that a whole range of seats that were under attack from Teal independents, Liberal seats were under attack from Teal independents, stayed Liberal. And these are areas that fell dramatically to independents at the federal election, but they didn't at the state level in New South Wales. And there is an obvious reason for that. Under Berejiklian and Perrottet, and arguably Baird and O'Farrell before them, you had a very centrist state government. You had a government that was focused on issues like female participation in the workforce, major reforms to the extent that state governments can do it, to childcare arrangements, for example, free kindergarten for kids, that type of thing. But also, most obviously, their support for strong climate action. So you had New South Wales rated by Worldwide Fund for Nature as having the best policies for renewable energy, for example. And it is those policies that I think led to us holding what we consider to be our heartland. Now, people will say, well, there are still significant swings. And one of the challenges, I think, for our state parliamentary teams is the perceptions about the Liberal Party, the Liberal brand, no matter what happens in state capitals, is largely determined by what people see happening out of Canberra. And I hope that we reach the point that we recognise that the approach that a Perrottet or a Berejiklian brought to New South Wales is what we need in Canberra if we're going to reflect modern Australia and politically have any chance of winning an election.
I mean, you know, the party's in a really difficult spot, right, because as a result of that teal wave, like a lot of contra voices in the federal parliamentary party room are missing now. And so, you know, that's reflected in the sort of things that Mark kind of just mentioned. And I guess I wonder, this is a really unfair question, Trent, so just gird yourself. But I mean, like, I wonder if ultimately it will be too difficult to recapture that ground federally, and that a sort of different party vehicle, a three-party coalition might be a more viable option. I mean, I know that states select candidates and they control great deals of resources, and so there's definitely a pathway back, but there is definitely some asymmetric challenges there.
Look, I honestly don't think the third-party option's likely to arise anytime soon, and I intend to stick with the party I've been a member of since I was 17 years old and keep fighting for the type of vision I have for our country and for our party.
Will you contest sorry to interrupt, Trent, but will you be seeking to re-enter the federal parliament at the next election?
Highly unlikely. I've moved on to a large degree. I miss the job. I love my job as an MP, but I had my shot is the way that I look at it. You never say never, but I'd be very surprised if I did. So, but look, I think we're at a point where those election results have taken out the moderate voice from the federal parliamentary party. The one thing that gives me hope is that at the end of the day, for any political leadership in any political party, electoral prospects do eventually have a huge influence on what you do. And I think that there'll be a point where the party has to realise, there are some that won't, but the party itself, the leadership itself, will have to realise that it needs to change tack on a couple of these issues. And you mentioned them, Mark. I mean, I think what Peter Dutton did in relation to working with the government on the Integrity Commission was very positive. The support that Dutton's leadership gave to childcare reforms was very important. But I think the big missing gap at the moment is moving on climate change, which is, in electorates like the one I represented, always the number one issue. We just haven't done anything to demonstrate to voters yet that we've listened to their concerns about climate change, and that's what we really have to do. I met him after the election, but I think David Cameron's pathway in the UK provides an interesting and relevant model for us. Cameron took over the Tories after they'd been out of office for a decade. They tried various leaders that tried a far more conservative approach. When he came in, he basically very quickly neutralised climate. In fact, arguably had stronger climate policies than the Labor government. But the other thing which he did, which I think is also an important part of this equation, is he transformed the Tory party in terms of how it represents modern Britain. And he personally drove the drive for more people of different ethnic backgrounds and more women. And the results of that you see today, the fact that you've got, I think, don't hold me to this, but 4 out of 5 of the most senior offices of state in Britain under a Tory government held by people of Asian or African heritage is one of David Cameron's legacies.
Yeah. I mean,
he provides a model, really.
Just quickly on that, did he suffer the sort of arguments against him that he was turning the Tories into Labor light? Because that is the sort of charge that always comes from the right and from the right-wing press. Mm. In this country.
Well, I mean, like they had, they'd gone through like, I think, 3 leaders by then and lost, kept losing. So yeah, of course he did face some dimensions of that. But I think what is an important difference is that, you know, the Conservatives in the UK is a highly centralised party. And so if Cameron says jump, everyone goes, okay. And the challenge that the Federal Liberal Party has is Dutton might say jump and New South Wales might say, nah, we're our own party. We're going to do what we like. And yeah. And that might be the thing that ultimately leads to this renaissance. We still have a strongly two-party system. Time and a messiah leader has worked in the past and may well work in the future.
So that's interesting, Trent. What Maria is saying there, I suppose, goes to your point to an extent, which is that if there is going to be this this rebuilding, this return to, you know, competitiveness, that it may actually come up through the states rather because of that federal structure. It almost has to, because unless it's going to be driven by a charismatic federal leader, and I think it's fair to say that that's not going to happen under the current one. And I'm not having a crack at his charisma. I might leave people to make their own judgment about that. But more the point about he's not a moderate, right? And he's not proposing to drive the Liberal Party back toward the centre. So perhaps it has to come from the states. We see much more moderate leaders of the Liberal Party all around the country. I think every premier, including the current Liberal Premier of Tasmania and the last Liberal Premier somewhere else, I'm just trying to remember where it was, but, you know, we're in fact pro-voice. So it's there's...
Well, Dom Perrottet.
Yeah.
Dom Perrottet, that's who it was, yes. Yes, we see, I suppose, government closer to the ground. What I wanted to ask you, Trent, though, is I suppose this is a long-term complaint that we hear about the moderates, which is that they do a lot of sort of talking, but there's not, they don't sort of end up with a lot of results. Now, I know that's easy to say against a group that usually doesn't have the numbers to actually, you know, drive outcomes all the time. But I'm wondering, at what point does this fight have to be had? And if not now, when? I mean, surely the time to have that big values fight within the Federal Liberal Party is right now when you're in opposition, rather than tearing a government apart, you know, whilst you're trying to govern the country. And there's some clear issues there. You've listed them out. There's the climate issue and there's the voice. Simon Birmingham has made clear his support for the voice. He's a leading moderate. And yet at the same time, he's not going to step down from his position. His position remains quite sort of ambiguous, a foot in each camp, really. And no one really expected that he would, because that has been the history of the moderates, to gesture in the right direction, to seem a bit more centrist than the rest of the party, but in the end, to toe the line.
Yeah, look, it's a really important issue, and I'd say two things. Firstly, I think historically moderates, and this was certainly my approach, have resiled against those that have sought to, fundamentally undermine the party's prospects through outwardly divisive tactics, the type of things that we saw where we had two senators, for example, in the last years of the Morrison government threatening to boycott votes in the Senate if they didn't get their way on policy issues. And I think moderates have always tried to be the grown-ups in the room on some of those things. But I think there are lessons for the moderates about how willing they are to pursue issues more aggressively within the party organisation, but also occasionally within the parliament. That's certainly a lesson from me from the last election. Obviously, we do it in every available channel that we have. And certainly that's something we were doing in the party room. And I think the moderates did have some success in the last federal parliament. I don't think we would have got the 2050 net zero commitment, exactly, for example, without the work that we collectively did. I certainly don't think that we would have got marriage equality if it hadn't been for the group of us that were willing to take it to the wire. And there's a whole range of other issues where that's come to the fore. But should the moderates be more aggressive about their positioning? I think that's right. And I think that, the challenge always is in this environment is that Liberal Party generally hands opposition periods very badly, and it keeps us in opposition for a long time. And I think about the Howard Peacock years, for example, which sadly I'm old enough to remember. So it is such a difficult balancing act. But this really is, it goes to both the heart of the party and its soul, but also to our electoral prospects. Now, I'm not someone that believes that moderates should prevail because in a complete sense, because I do think the Liberal Party is at its strongest when it's got the balance between Liberals and Conservatives right. We seek to represent a broad spectrum of the centre-right spectrum. But at the moment, I don't think that balance is there, and that's the challenge.
I should say a shout-out here to Bridget Archer and Andrew Bragg, the New South Wales Senator, and Bridget Archer, the member for Bass in Tasmania federally, both been very outspoken on The Voice and on some other issues. Bridget Archer's crossed the floor a number of times. There have been people who have been prepared to, I think, take on damage to their career prospects to pursue issues, and that they ought to be recognised. And as you say, Trent, a number of moderates are very influential in the same-sex marriage, pushing that through, and quite clearly Abbott didn't want to take it anywhere. It ended up, happening under Turnbull, but the progress toward it, a lot of the hard fight, as you would know, as you were part of, was done while Abbott was there, and Abbott was no friend of the issue.
And even well before that, I particularly should give a shout out to Warren Entsch, who was almost a sole voice. So
yes,
he was arguing for marriage equality during that awkward period where Penny Wong was voting no. So yeah. he was the real trooper and stayer on this issue.
Yes, interesting, isn't it, Queensland's role in this? I mean, you can talk about Bill Hayden, for example. He's still alive, former Labor leader up until Bob Hawke displaced him just before that 83 election. Bill Hayden was pursuing homosexual law reform in the AWU-run Queensland branch of the Labor Party in 1967 and 68, and taking on a lot of damage for it. When I say damage, taking on a lot of argument. A lot of these fights happen, I suppose, behind closed doors, and it must be frustrating when you can't take those matters public. You might be fighting the fight, but not really getting a lot of public credit for it, because at the same time you're trying to keep the peloton of government tight, or peloton of the party tight. Yeah,
peloton, a great word. I'll use that in my next next piece.
Okay. Well, look, it's been really good talking to you, Trent. Really enjoyed this conversation, and I think people will have seen a different perspective to an issue that gets gets ventilated a lot. People, you know, voters are frustrated about what they do see and don't see in politics. But it's the practice of it is a complicated business, let's say. There are competing imperatives and issues, long-term and short-term considerations and the like. So thanks for taking us into that world a bit.
Yeah, thanks for answering our unfair questions.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All the very best to you. And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. I will just say again that we have a an email address, democracysausage@anu.edu.au. So if you want to send us an email and give us any feedback, feel free to do so. Unless it's hostile, we'll probably get back to you.
Well, some of you, many of you have sent emails, and I hope we're managing to reply to them all. And mostly they've been positive.
Yes, they have. Yeah. It's really terrific. And you know, if you've got any ideas about things you'd like us to do, then we're all ears or all eyes or whatever it is with an email. That's it for now. Talk again next week.
Bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.